You know, I was never much one for reading instructions. Couldn't be bothered. You know, if I bought a new appliance, I figured, well, I know how to use this. Why read 3 pages of directions? But after a few minor disasters, I've learned to pay more attention to the manufacturer's guidelines. In fact, I found that reading the instructions can even be a little bit of fun sometimes because they overstate the obvious. Like if you buy a Rowenta iron, it has a warning on it that says, do not iron clothes on your body. You think, somebody must have done that. Or maybe you buy a set of those auto shades, you know, those folding blinds that you put inside the windshield of your car on a hot day. And they're for summertime when everyone else's car is 45 Celsius inside, but not yours. It's only 43 Celsius because you have auto shades. Well, I read that the instructions that come with these auto shades are as follows. 1, unfold the auto shades in the car. 2, push the cutout portion behind where the rear view mirror is. 3, pull the sun visors down to hold the auto shades in place. And 4 is a warning. Do not drive car with auto shades in place. And, you know, instructions seem overly obvious sometimes, but it's still worthwhile to read them. After all, the manufacturer is the one who knows the product. The guidelines are there and meant to protect you and to make sure that you get the best out of the product. Now, when it comes to the great institution of marriage, it's important for us to remember that it was God's idea, that marriage was God's invention. And marriage actually comes with some basic instructions from the Maker, along with some warnings to protect you and help you get the most out of marriage. So God's instruction manual, the Bible, is a guidebook for all of life, but maybe especially for marriage. I mean, just consider the fact that the Bible begins in Genesis with the wedding of Adam and Eve, where God himself conducts that wedding there in the Garden of Eden. And then the Bible ends in Revelation with another wedding, the wedding of Christ and the church. So the Bible is intentionally framed by these two momentous and all-important marriages, Adam and Eve, Christ and the church. So maybe, just maybe, the secret of marriage can be found within the pages of God's book. And maybe we should, you know, make every effort to understand it, to follow its instructions. Now, when I first met with Wendy and Marv to discuss their wedding, the subject of premarital counseling came up. And immediately Marv asked, all excited, are we going to talk about sex? And I thought, well, you guys aren't spring chickens. You know as much as I do about that. So I ordered a book for them. I gave them a reading assignment, and the book's not what you think, though. It's not just about sex. It's a really great book on Christian marriage by Timothy Keller. It's called The Meaning of Marriage, and I highly recommend it. And if Marv and Wendy haven't been doing their homework, well, they haven't got much time now. So this morning, for a few minutes before we marry them off, I'm going to draw just a few thoughts from this book and also from God's instruction manual. Now, at the beginning of the Bible, in Genesis chapter 2, God creates Adam from the dust of the ground, breathes the breath of life into him, and puts him in the Garden of Eden, which was a very good place to be. But as good as that was, God said, it is not good for the man to be alone. So he made woman. And not from just another handful of dirt, but from a part of the man. It tells us from Adam's rib. And so God used the first human being to make the second, which explains the very close relationship between a man and a woman. It's almost as if the woman was born from the man, except for their gender, they have the same genetic makeup, which explains their attraction for each other. And so they find a part of themselves in each other, something that complements one another. And when God brought Adam and Eve together there in the Garden of Eden, Adam said in verse 23 of Genesis 2, "Wow!" No, it's not there in the text, but I'm pretty sure he said, "Wow!" He says, "This at last is bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called Isha," the Hebrew word for woman, "because she was taken out of Ish," the Hebrew word for man. So Isha was taken out of Ish. And then what happens is God officiates the very first wedding right there in the garden. And the next verse, verse 24, forms for us the most profound and fundamental statement in all of Scripture concerning God's plan and instructions for marriage ever afterward. Here's what it says. "Therefore, a man shall leave his father and his mother and hold fast to his wife, and they shall become one flesh." So there's a leaving and a cleaving here. Husband leaves his parents and cleaves to or holds fast to his wife. And so he gives priority to his wife over all other human relationships, even of that with his parents. Very important. And that bond is meant to be stronger than any other human relationship. So everything in Genesis 2 tells us that marriage, next to our relationship with God, is the most profound relationship there is. It says the two will become one flesh. You don't get any closer than that. Husband and wife weave the most intimate union as they merge themselves together, physically, sexually, emotionally, and spiritually. But that merging that takes place doesn't happen instantaneously. Notice that it says there, "they shall become one flesh," not "they became one flesh." Oneness is not created overnight. One honeymoon does not a marriage make. And so marital oneness is meant to be a lifelong emotional and sexual quest. So according to Genesis 2 here, we were made for marriage and marriage was made for us. But that doesn't make marriage easy. The very next chapter in Genesis, chapter 3, tells us that marriage, along with every other aspect of human life, has been broken because of sin. It means it's partly dysfunctional. It means we are partly dysfunctional. Because marriage, ever since the fall of Adam and Eve, has been a union of two sinners. And that's why coming to know and love your spouse, like knowing and loving God Himself, can be rewarding and wonderful, but it can also be difficult and painful. Sometimes so difficult and painful that marriages don't survive it. Any two people who enter into marriage are spiritually broken by sin, which among other things means, well, we're self-centered. We bring a certain amount of baggage into the marriage. Now, Philip Keller, in his book here, uses a helpful analogy. He says, think of an old bridge over a stream. And imagine that there's structural defects in that bridge that are hard to see. Maybe some hairline fractures that are a very close inspection would reveal, but to the naked eye, there's nothing wrong. But now see a 10-ton Mack truck drive onto that bridge. What will happen? The pressure from the weight of the truck will open those hairline fractures so they can be seen. The structural defects will be exposed for all to see because of the strain the truck puts on the bridge. Suddenly we can see where all the flaws are. But the truck didn't create the weaknesses. It just revealed them. And Keller says, when you get married, your spouse is a big truck driving right through your heart. Marriage brings out the worst in you, reveals your weaknesses, can also bring out the best. But Keller also says, this is not a bad thing, because it gives us the opportunity to grow and improve. Marriage confronts you with yourself. And so marriage, by its very nature, has the power of truth, you know, the power to show you the truth about who you are. And that can be a difficult process, but it can also be a liberating process. Marriage counselors will tell you that the only flaws that can really enslave you are the ones that you're blind to. And so one of the purposes of marriage is to expose the flaws and help each other to change, to become better people. In a survey done by the National Marriage Project, people were asked what compatibility means in marriage. And some of the men who did the survey described compatibility as finding a woman who will fit into their life. One guy said naively, if you're truly compatible, then you don't have to change. Think again, guy. You know, a realistic view of marriage says that no two people are completely compatible. Everyone who enters marriage is spiritually broken in one way or another by sin. We all have rough edges that don't fit together. And then over time, you know, for better or worse, marriage changes us. So the person that you're married to today is not quite the same person they were on your wedding day. Neither are you. And I don't just mean their appearance. You know, when Kim and I got together, we seemed pretty compatible. But I never thought when I married I'd actually have to change. But no one has caused more change in my life than Kim. Good change. But some of it's been a little rocky. Philip Keller uses another analogy for marriage. He says marriage is like one of those rock tumblers, you know, where you put the gems and stones in the tumbler and then you turn it on for a long period of time, and those stones get brought into constructive and creative contact with each other. And they knock the rough edges off each other until those stones are smooth and beautiful. But if you don't put that special compound into the tumbler with those gems, those stones will just either bounce off one another without any effect, or they will collide and crack and shatter each other. So this grinding compound that you put in the gem tumbler is like God's grace in a marriage. Without the power of grace, it's very hard to combine truth and love. Spouses will either stay away from the truth and just bounce off each other, or else they'll collide with one another until they shatter. And so a good marriage is not because you're married to a perfectly compatible person. That person doesn't even exist. Marriage is two flawed people coming together by God's grace and creating a space of stability and love, mutual respect, and forgiveness. So what then is marriage for? Asks Philip Keller. It's for helping each other to become our future glory selves, the new creations that God will eventually make us. So instead of expecting marriage to just be a way of fulfilling our own personal satisfactions, what if we expected marriage instead to be about helping each other grow out of our sins and flaws and into the new self that God is creating? Now that foundational verse about marriage in Genesis 2:24 is also echoed at least three times in the New Testament. Jesus quotes Genesis 2:24 to the Pharisees, Matthew 19:5 and Mark 10:7. It's when they question him about divorce. And the Apostle Paul also quotes this verse in Genesis in Ephesians 5:31 to 32. Now, a couple weeks ago, Tom Williams, one of our elders, brought a good message from this passage. And the Apostle Paul is talking here about the relationship of husbands and wives in marriage and how marriage is actually meant to reflect the relationship of Christ and the church, and vice versa. So Paul quotes Genesis 2:24. I'll just read it again. Therefore, a man shall leave his father and mother and hold fast to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. And then he adds in the next verse, verse 32, this mystery is profound, and I'm saying that it refers to Christ and the church. He's literally saying this is a mega mystery. He's saying there's a hidden meaning to the oneness of marriage that's super profound, because it's a picture of the way Christ and the church are one. So the hidden meaning of Genesis 2:24 is now revealed here in verse 32 of Ephesians 5. Christ's people, the church, are his bride, united to him in one body. So the formation of Eve to be Adam's companion here is seen to prefigure the creation of the church to be the bride of Christ. So when God invented marriage, he already had the saving work of Jesus in mind. And marriage is meant to be a reflection of the gospel, of the saving love of Christ for us. So through marriage, the mystery of the gospel is unveiled. And what is the gospel? Well, the gospel is that you are so lost, you're so flawed, you're so sinful that Jesus had to die for you, but you're also so loved and valued that Jesus was glad to die for you. That's the gospel. What Jesus wanted to do was reach out to us. So what did he do? He came down into our world, met us right where we are, and he gave himself for us on the cross. Now, just a few verses earlier, Paul says in verse 25, something that connects with this. He says, husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. That's the model for love in marriage. And this is why marriage can be both painful and wonderful at the same time. Because it's meant to be a reflection of the gospel, which is also painful and wonderful at the same time. Wonderful because it means salvation, but painful because there's a cross in it. So the secret of marriage is that the gospel of Jesus Christ and marriage actually explain one another. The gospel helps us understand marriage, and marriage helps us understand the gospel. So what's the secret to making a marriage work? Well, it's the gospel of Jesus Christ and how it gives us both the power and the pattern for marriage. So what does that gospel secret really look like, though, in a marriage? How does it play out in the husband-wife relationship? Well, it looks a lot like this little story, a true story from a book called A Promise Kept. And it's the story of Robertson McQuilkin, a former missionary and a respected seminary president. And Robertson McQuilkin willingly gave up his distinguished post at the seminary because his wife Muriel had Alzheimer's disease. And he decided he would step down from that position and dedicate himself full time for as long as the Lord deemed it necessary for him to take care of his wife. And he writes of traveling with his wife after that time. He says, once our flight was delayed in Atlanta and we had to wait a couple of hours. Now that's a challenge, he says, because every few minutes we'd take a fast-paced walk down the terminal in earnest search of what? Muriel had always been a speed walker, and I had to jog along to keep up with her. There was this attractive woman executive type who was sitting just across from us working on her computer. And once when we returned from one of these excursions, she said something without looking up from her papers. And since no one else was nearby, I assumed she had spoken to me, or at least mumbled in protest of our constant activity. Pardon? I asked. Oh, she said, I was just asking myself, will I ever find a man to love me like that? And you know what McQuilkin said to that woman? He said, oh yes, you can find a man like that. You can find a man like that because I found a man like that. The only reason that I love my wife the way you see me loving her is because the man Jesus first loved me. The only resources I have to draw upon to love my wife the way I do are the resources that he gives me. And mirrored in my relationship here with my wife, you can see the faithful love of God for me. Wow. So you see, the gospel helps us to understand marriage, and marriage helps us to understand the gospel. The secret of marriage, the power of marriage, the power and pattern for marriage, the instructions for marriage are all found in the gospel of Jesus Christ, who willingly gave himself for us and loved us unconditionally. So it was God who invented marriage. It comes with God's instructions and a pattern to follow that's clearly seen in the love of Christ. Now, before we witness a wonderful wedding here, I'm going to invite the worship team to come up. We're going to sing that great song, Amazing Grace. Wendy and Marv asked for this song. We're going to sing that together, and then I'll be inviting them to come up.